Hello, and welcome to the Gentleman's Journal podcast, a new fortnightly discussion all about success, modern business, and the lives of entrepreneurs. I'm Joe Bullmore. I'll be your host for the day, and I'm joined this afternoon upstairs in the Indian Room at Mark's Club by Pierre Lagrange, the financier, hedge fund veteran, and now Savile Row head honcho. Pierre began his career at JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs before forming GLG Partners with two colleagues in the mid-90s. It was then the poster child of the flourishing London hedge fund scene, and when it was acquired in 2010 by the Man Group, it was the largest acquisition in hedge fund history. But in 2013, Pierre changed tack completely and purchased Huntsman, the much-loved Savile Row tailor. He's now its CEO. Today, Pierre tells us how a chance encounter in Ibiza changed the course of his life, how love at first sight in business is not a good thing, and why the American Ralph Lauren is the world's best British brand. I'd also like to say that at one point during our recording, Pierre managed to eat two entire schnitzels with fried eggs and capers on top of them in about 3 minutes flat, which suggests there's probably a third career for him in gourmet speed eating. Anyway, enjoy. Thank you very much for coming to join us, Pierre.
Thank you, Joe.
I'd love to start with GLG Partners, which was the hedge fund you set up with two colleagues back in 1995. And at the time, I think you had a job at JP Morgan, is that right?
And actually, that was after JP Morgan. JP Morgan, I left JP Morgan from Belgium to come to London and work at Goldman Sachs.
Oh, okay. But you had a job at Goldman Sachs. And what made you decide to strike out on your own and start your own venture?
We actually were organized as a kind of partnership within Goldman Sachs. Okay. So it was a structure where I had teamed up with a couple of colleagues who became great friends. And we felt that we could build some franchise on our own, as great as Goldman Sachs was and is, that there was a room to build an asset management business at that time.
And back then in the mid-90s, there was kind of a bit of a boom for hedge funds, wasn't there? Quite a few cropped up at the same time, and that was maybe due to the slightly stronger stock market at the time. Do you think you'd still start the same business today in this current climate?
I think there's still room, absolutely. Things are different, obviously, and the competitive landscape is different, like in many other businesses. But still, I would start it again. And I think it was as much, it's a little bit like people remember, the golden, 60s or 70s or 80s. When we were living at that time, it didn't look that golden.
Right.
And so we always have an extraordinary vision of how good things were before and or things that now it's so much more difficult. And, old people tend to laugh at that because it didn't really look rosy then.
So you were doing something slightly different to the traditional model. When did you realize that it was working and you were going to be a success with GLG Partners? Did it take a long time, or was there a kind of period at the beginning when you set it up when you were slightly nervous as to the strategy you were taking?
It was not about the strategy.
Right.
It was about the business. When we set up, we had you always have to take a gamble whether, people are going to follow you.
Yeah.
You're not leaving a bucket shop. We were leaving Goldman Sachs to set up. And so therefore, we had taken a view of, which client is likely to come. And we had a couple of clients who we were quite sort of sure were likely to come.
Yeah.
And actually, a very big one didn't come. And so that was quite a challenging few days where we realized, now we think we know what we're doing. And it's not about the return. It's about, we're going to need the assets to produce these returns. Yeah. And so it was like rebuilding the client base looked very sort of dicey for a couple of months. But, we're all salespeople at heart, and so we basically went on the road, and then actually proved to our clients and new people that actually we were doing well.
So you're now the chairman and owner of Huntsman on Savile Row. And
yes.
What made you decide to make that? I mean, they're quite different worlds, finance and tailoring. What made you decide to jump into that world?
A total coincidence. Right. We were at a dinner in Ibiza, actually, of all places. And a good friend of mine thought he should introduce my boyfriend at the time to not a friend of ours who was the lead on the private equity group that owned Huntsman.
Yeah.
So it was one of these total coincidences, because after the dinner, my partner at the time just came to me and said, "Hey, your friend wants me to do something with Huntsman." And I actually was not really too sure what Huntsman was. You know, it was like the... Of course, it was not a chemical company that I knew, because, you know, even though he was an engineer, that was not the idea. But I had actually really... I don't think I'd ever been into a shop on Savile Row, apart from when Jill Sander was in what is now Abercrombie,
right,
20 years ago, because I, you know, always was quite happy with ready to wear.
Yeah.
Because I fit, if I don't eat too much, in really... I don't have a model size, but I actually am kind of a 50-52 template. So, and so I never really got the bug before. I got the bug, the bespoke bug, for a lot of other things like cars, motorcycles, guns, jewelry. So done a lot of bespoke commission for that for many years. But for some reason, coats and suits and jacket, never. And so it was a total coincidence.
Yeah.
There was one thing, though, that then, okay, well, it's not all about being love and then just sort of buy it because of that. I looked at a couple of businesses over the years, including Halston, including one great, absolutely phenomenal designer who left Dior, and who was going to go on his own. And I absolutely freaked out at the competitive landscape of the fashion industry at the time. And I just thought, you know what? It's very glamorous, but, you know, like every glamorous business, it's quite tough. Mm. And I sort of felt that, you know, the fashion, you know, it was interesting with the guy who was, you know, starting from Dior. It was like very quick, like, okay, we're going to need tens of million dollars to basically put this brand on orbit. So because you need to go into the season's calendar, you need to go into the marketing calendar, you need to do, you know, how many collections.
Yeah.
And so like I was having dinner yesterday, birthday, with a friend whose wife is a designer. She just finished the fashion week. She's getting all the design for next season through.
Yeah.
And so it is like the recreation of everything every couple of months. Mm. It's, if you think about it, in industrial business, the product's obsolescence is difficult, but in fashion, it's like one season if you're going to be at that level. So when, and then Halston, I felt I loved the idea. I loved the guy when he was alive. And, you know, it was like a Studio 54 legend. And quite amazing guy, came out with a couple of sort of breakthroughs like Diane von Furstenberg did with that wrap dress. He had a sort of another, I forgot now, but quite a story, sort of elegant sort of Upper East Side caftan. But the heritage could not be leveraged in so much as, let's say, the heritage at Gucci or this sort of thing. So I felt it is not going to be that easy.
Yeah.
And I also thought at the time it should be an American designer basically taking over Alston. Yeah. And that's not what the lead investor was doing, so I decided not to. So when the Huntsman opportunity came, I thought, okay, this is interesting because it's about style as opposed to fashion.
Yeah.
It's about doing the best thing again and again and again. And, you know, We just got, like, a couple of months ago, the cousin of a friend of mine just brought a jacket from 1925 that her husband is still using from their grandfather. And it's an amazing hacking jacket. And then when you see it in the shop, people want the same.
Yeah.
This is like nearly 100 years old.
Yeah.
And that's what's phenomenal. You know, suits have not changed that much.
Mm.
The cut has been refined. I mean, we're still wearing because, and actually there's a reason, it's comfortable.
Yeah.
And which is interesting. A lot of people think a suit is actually something that you have to wear. But actually, yeah. I realized that actually, if you've got a good suit, it's comfortable, it's empowering you, it's conveying, you know, the image that you want.
Yeah.
And so, I actually really like that about the business, which is it's got a permanency as opposed to be restarted every quarter and then competing against, you know, the LVMH group and the Kering group for a place in the sun in all the magazines and a place in the sun in all the retailing area. Just thought that is great because that's exactly the opposite. It's a bespoke business, it's private, it's known by the people who need to, it's known a little bit by the others, so we've got some work to do so people get aware. But then once you have people aware, then they love it.
Yeah.
And it's not about doing something new every season. Now, it's great to have new fabrics and new, you know, new cloths and a couple of new things. But I think, you know, probably 80% doesn't change. Done better, but it doesn't change. You know, we come with something for the spring, we come something for the winter. It's going to be, you know, some refinement, but not major change, which makes it a totally different business. And then I fell in love with the business. I just fell in love with the fact that, you know, I walk through the place and then you can have everything made, which is, you know, in this world where you see the same thing everywhere, having something just made for you is just super cool.
And what was it like from a personnel point of view? Obviously, you were used to dealing with kind of hedge fund managers and quants before. Now you were dealing with cutting staff and creative directors. How different was that from just a personal point of view or a staffing point of view?
Actually, it's there's a very strong similarity and then a very, very big difference is that, and I'll start with the similarity. I built the business on the hedge fund side by becoming better and better at analyzing where I'm strong and where I'm weak, at getting people to deal with what I'm weak. Or, you know, to be more like positive, where you're strong or stronger.
Yeah.
And so therefore the whole idea, and it's kind of Mayo industrial architecture, you know, you just, we are like a chain. So you just get, okay, you focus on that, you focus on that, you focus on that. Now, how do you know that? And so it's a lot of behavioral analysis. So data mining has been exceptionally strong for that, where you do the psychology questionnaires.
Yeah.
And then you validate that by empirical evidence, where you analyze every single data, where you can see that when somebody, you know, puts a blue jacket, is going to make more money than when he puts a gray jacket. I'm joking, but it's not that far.
Yeah.
So you can really analyze and predict the performance of people.
Wow.
Based on behavior. And yes, because it's interesting. For instance, if you take a good fund manager who's going to take a lot of investment decision, buying and selling all the time, a very good fund manager is going to be right 65% of the time. It's super rare that somebody's right more than that. So the key thing is that it's to accept that. So it's kind of acceptance philosophically. And then to see, okay, well, what can I do to make sure that when I'm going to be wrong, because I'm going to be wrong one time out of three at best. Mm. And most people, it's like one time out of two. So if I tell you a good guy is wrong one time out of two, you say, well, he's not that good, is he? Well, actually, that's the reality. So you first have to sort of, okay, well, I have to deal with the reality, not with the perception. And then you say, okay, well, if I'm going to be wrong all that time, I need to manage how much I'm going to be wrong by.
Okay.
And that's probably the most important area.
So you're when you're right bigger than when you're wrong. Is that right?
That's hopefully. So that's if you're 50-50, yeah. that's how you make money, is okay. that when you're right, you let's say you're right for twice the magnitude, yeah. that's when you're wrong, and then you've got a good business.
Yeah.
If it reverses, you've got a problem. But you could actually be, and that, by the way, between the three of us here in this room, we would have a different profile. Yeah. There would be people who actually will be right 50-50, but they will just eke, let's say, a little bit more when they're yeah. right than when they're wrong.
Okay.
There would be people who would be right, let's say, only 40% of the time. But God, when they're right, they make a killing.
Yeah.
And that lifts everything, which, by the way, is the profile of venture capital. You look at any fund from a venture capital, you know, the guys who got Snapchat
yeah.
and that made a killing yesterday. Mm-hmm. If you look at the vintage of the fund that are invested in that, they're probably going to give you a good return, but it probably will come from three companies out of the 20 they've invested in the yeah. portfolio. The others are dead. So that's, you know, you've got a very, very low hit ratio, but you make a killing on the ones yeah. you write. So that's so you have to find out what's the right way for you to position okay. yourself based on your strengths and weakness that you can analyze with quantitative work.
At the time of the recession, quite a lot of the tailoring houses on Savile Row were kind of hanging on by a thread, to borrow the title or the tabloids. And I think William Fung came in and bought basically a whole corner of the row. And then you've obviously come in and helped out. Some people were worried that that was going to change the atmosphere of a very historic street and a very historic style capital. Do you think that's been the case, or what was your take on that?
Actually, I don't see that. I think there's more risk of change if people let business die.
Yeah.
And so therefore, that's a worry. So,
and do you think those businesses would have died perhaps?
Well, some of them did.
Yeah.
Yeah, some of them did. And, you know... It's like most of us don't own the real estate.
Mm.
And because, you know, that's the things that I had to go when things were really tough. And so that's actually where, you know, you need to grow. If you don't grow, you stand still. You're much more vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I think the philosophy, you know, someone needs to explain to me why the Italians, if you look at Rubinacci, I think, mm-hmm. They've got one place in Piazza Le Londra, I think, in Naples, where it's kind of a joke. That's where, you know, the Italians have been killing Savile Row
yeah.
by, you know, taking the British thing, evolving it, listening more to what their clients wanted, and build empires out of British tailoring. The other one is, you know, I always joke with my ex-partner at the time that, for me, the best British brand or the best success in British brand, what is it? What is the name that comes to mind? And it's actually Ralph Lauren. Who is a idiot?
American.
It's American. Right. Of course it's American. But if you look at it, it's the quintessential
yeah.
perception of Britishness and Britishness. And so he actually has done it like nobody else in this country. And so therefore, I think it's because things have not been embraced, the row has not embraced change enough and be willing to look forward.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what happens, where you just sit on a gold mine and then you let, you know, competition come in, and before you know, you become legacy as opposed to being current. And so I'm all for people who are looking to, you know, improve the row. And I think actually the most amazing people on that are the landlord, actually. It's the it's the Crown Estate running for the Norwegian Central Bank. And they're a super smart landlord. They understand the idiosyncrasy of what's on the row. You know, I had very good meetings with them where they sort of asked me, okay, well, I could ask you the question, actually. What shops would you want to see next to you?
Yeah.
What do you want to be on each side of the row? And imagine that these places were free and it was not for you because you've got the space you want. What would you want? Which is, they really want to think like an ecosystem of, you know.
You can't have Starbucks opening up on
Well, it would not really make sense. No. Well, there's one around the corner, which is very practical, so you don't have to go quite far. But the point is that there's actually no street like that in the world. It's crazy. There used to be in Shanghai a street called Street of Happiness, where the qipao, which is the sort of traditional Shanghai sort of dress, were made, where there were tailors specialized in that. But that's gone with the revolution. There's a few guys sort of still alive. But in terms of a street dedicated to man bespoke tailoring, you don't have that. And we have to really... And I hesitate to say protect. Of course, we need to protect. But the best protection is to make it successful. Yeah. So, you know, if the Fungs are doing something that's going to make it successful, you know, let's not forget that actually the Fungs had, if I remember correctly, they had the licensing for Gives in Asia or China.
Right.
And then the main company went into difficulty, and so they bought the mother company.
Yeah.
So it's the licensee who bought. Huntsman went into a similar situation 20 years ago or 30 years ago, I can't remember, where it's actually an extraordinary gentleman from Japan who owns railways and also textile manufacturers, who basically rescued Huntsman from difficulties.
Mm.
So it was a licensee for Japan who basically did that and then actually sold Huntsman to you know, the employees and a management team. Yeah. So that's nothing new.
No.
And I think we should just welcome that.
Definitely.
If people put the rule in the right place.
So aside from tailoring and obviously your more traditional investments, you've also invested in art, I believe, and movies in particular. What's the kind of consideration there when you're investing in that? Is it very much a gut feeling when you read a script, or is it still done from a business point of view?
So art is not an investment, although it's been one of the best investments I've made, because I never bought it as an investment.
You just bought it because you liked
just
it.
Just bought it as a sort of the legendary butterfly in the stomach. Like,
right.
I love this.
Okay.
I can probably not afford it, but I can, and then therefore I have to have it.
Yeah.
But
it's paid off in the case of some pieces.
Yes, I suppose it has. Yeah. No, it's actually been quite nice. But also I want to live with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's something that's really emotional.
Yeah.
But I do pay a lot of attention. I've got a son who's in that business too, and I read a lot. I would not buy just on a whim because, you know, one great advisor once told me that you have to be super careful of work that flat, that sort of love at first sight is super dangerous because it could really be flattery. That's something that talking to you in an obvious way, you know, like a wine with too much alcohol gets you drunk quickly, but that's not the good thing. The good stuff is a different stuff. That's got more of the sort of the taste behind that comes through. And so therefore, I read a lot. I spend a lot of time sort of discussing with people. And so that's how it's been, because the money has become quite big. So it protects the money that you put in because you just don't buy things which are just too crazy. The movie is very different. I lost a lot of money in movies when I did it emotionally.
Right.
What movies today? Which has been a disaster. Or the movie on Nina Simone, which has been an absolute nightmare, because actually the movie is pretty good.
Yeah.
But the casting, with hindsight, was an absolutely horrendous mistake that we casted, you know, an artist that was not appropriate for playing an iconic, very dark African-American lady, Nina. And so with hindsight, that was a big mistake.
And there was some press backlash that, wasn't there?
There was some press backlash because it didn't help that the production... No, I was passive in that, you know, which as an executive producer, which is the only thing I've ever done, you basically are quite passive. So you really have to trust the production. And the production actually, you know, didn't get the daughter on board. So therefore, the Dota plus the wrong casting made it like an absolute nightmare. So that was money going down the drain, which is a shame also because the movie is good, and but it's going to be seen by very few people. But also I've got a really good friend of mine introduced me to Matthew Vaughn, who became a good friend like a long time ago. And he was producing movies with Matthew, and then I sort of joined them. And so I've done a couple of things with him, and that was really good, actually, because he, in that world, finding directors who are also producer and who are smart at managing budget is super rare.
Yeah.
And he is. And so it's been fun because it's fun movies. It's very risky. You know, I just thought the hedge fund business is risky, but this is even more crazy. I don't know if you know that, but so I may make a mess, but if I remember correctly, you are spending most of your marketing budget in the sort of the 2 or 3 weeks before the movie is launched. And I remember it was for Stardust, where, and by the way, the other rule of thumb is that you spend in advertising and marketing roughly the amount that you've the movie has cost.
Wow.
So if it's a 100 million movie, you're going to spend 100 million in marketing, and you're going to spend most of it in the 3 weeks before on billboards, TV, you name it. Now, the crazy thing is that, so you spend all that money, and the first weekend is super important. And it's all about trying to understand what the other big distribution studios have. And then, so everybody's trying to vaguely coordinate and be like Sotheby's and Christie's are not having the auction on the same night. Yeah. But as I said, everybody's competing. So Fox, Universal, and they all be sort of like, so you have to sort of make sure you are when there's not another five blockbusters. Because at the end of the day, most people don't go that much to the cinema.
No.
So you want to be that movie that people are going to go and see this weekend. Because if the first weekend is bad, you're dead. It's very rare that you can catch up before.
So you know pretty much straight away.
Oh, yes, you do. And I think they might even be able to do data mining now, which is like, your total revenues is likely to be a multiple of the first weekend with a relatively tight range.
Yeah.
So we're having all this money spent on Tardus, which was really a great movie, absolutely hysterical. And here comes the weekend. And I think on that day, I think we're talking about October, if I remember correctly. It's super shiny. The sun is like, it's heat wave. You know, it's England's at its best. Nobody wants to be inside. If they're going to be inside, there was Lewis Hamilton in the last Grand Prix of the season to gain the title. And there was England in the rugby final, which hadn't happened for a long time too. So you suddenly said, damn. You spend all this money to get these guys that weekend to see that movie, and boom, you know, if you're a bit unlucky.
Wow.
So in terms of, risk management, whoa, I just thought that's another. So you have to be super careful. That's why you can't do this just because you love it, because you're just going to lose everything. So it's a super tight business to run, but it's tough.
But fun.
So it's only a hobby. Yeah.
And so what's next then for Pierre Lagrange? What's next on the investment list? What are your plans for this year?
I'm very busy right now. You know, I'm advisor to the Man Group, and we've got a lot of things going on there, which I sort of work with the team on strategy. I think we extraordinary position. It was your opening question about would I do this today again? Yes, absolutely. But you need to retool yourself.
Yeah.
And, everybody's talking about AI. I went to, I did a 1 week executive course in September to a place that just fascinated called Singularity University. And so it's 1 week in the future. And you can see the same way as I've applied the separation of task and the allocation of tasks based on skills to people. Well, one of these people is now, AI. And so therefore, it's all a matter of saying, okay, let's take a view from all the stuff that we do, whether it's on the investment management or on another business, what is it that can be done by AI? And there's more and more. And so it's a matter of embracing that as opposed to opposing it, because opposing it is going to be squashed long term.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's embracing it. Like Siri. Did you ever work with Siri?
Kind of. It doesn't usually work that well.
Okay, well, exactly the same thing. So I thought Siri was a bit of a joke. Mm. Then the other day I had a GoToMeet session with one of my IT advisors, and we were sharing a screen. You know, the guy is somewhere else, God knows where, and we're sharing a screen. And I see the Siri icon, and I see Siri writing PS Excel spreadsheet from yesterday.
Wow.
And suddenly the icon of the Excel spreadsheet is coming out. So I click on the mute button and said, what did you do? I said, well, I just asked Siri to find me the email where there was your spreadsheet. I said, Siri can do that?
Yeah.
I said, yeah, it's a new Siri. It came out 2 months ago. So Siri has actually been trained now to do things like that, which I just said, whoa. So suddenly it's like, you can ask, do you play with Amazon Echo and Alexa?
Yes, I've got two in my house, in fact.
Which is crazy. Yeah. So how much are you now not Google searching anymore by just asking her to, what's the weather now?
And I think it's a different thing, isn't it? It's slightly different.
It's slightly different, but it's taking quite a lot of it. So you then suddenly think, hey, wait a second, how is that going to affect advertising revenue on search?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, so I love that. And I think at Man, because we've got that extraordinary quantitative business, the qualitative business discretionary that I built, and then having the two together, which is what we did 2 years ago, beyond the cost allocation, was really how can we be smart by using AI. And so we've got a chair in Oxford that we've endowed basically purely devoted to that.
Wow.
And so that's absolutely super exciting. And then I'm helping the team at Huntsman to really go from strength to strength and you know, have the best bespoke business possible. So no other new projects right now. No, absolutely not.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Pierre, for coming in.
Great. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very, very much for listening to this episode of the Gentleman's Journal podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight with more invaluable insights from the world of entrepreneurs. But until then, you can find us on our website, which is www.thegentlemansjournal.com. Or if you're so inclined, follow us on Instagram at The Gents Journal, or indeed on Twitter at The Gents Journal. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you very, very soon.